Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. Let's get on into it.
First order of business
for the Gingerbread Man today is a discussion on what is love? Baby, don't hurt me. But for real, what is love? I know I talk about it basically every episode because it's one of the crucial standpoints that I like to consider when it comes to these basic attributes being a human and being a life form, being alive and interacting with others. And love is this quality of interaction between other people and you, or between other life forms, like even the method of population control with deer. You know, with less wolves, there was less wolves to eat the deer, and so now we have all these weird laws where they kind of try to push it, the hunting of the deer, because if the populations get too high, then all of a sudden they don't have enough food for themselves. And so there's like this artificial culling that humans take part in. But behind the violence, behind the aggression, behind whatever emotional impact you have towards such an idea, the reason is for this stability to be at some point instilled. So love is complex. Love is not simply just relatable love. It's not just being in a needing relationship with somebody. Love is something that can be freely given. And one of the things that really has me concerned right now, at least in the United States, is this massive division between people. And when there are such lines drawn between two interacting parties and the discourse no longer flows and there's no way to actively grow from that standpoint because of this divisiveness, then I see an immense lack of love. And so, especially right now, to me, it feels like a very important idea. And also something I'd like you to consider, as always, is what creativity is. How we live creatively. How all of our choices make an artistic expression for how our lives are. We make ourselves, and through that action, we make our world. The Buddha said that that everything in the universe is a product of mind. And this mind is not the little psyche that we always play around in. It's not the captain's seat. It's not the sense of I where we make these decisions, you know. But from that stance of I, we have impact. We create new trends. We create new possibilities, new policies. And by interacting with one another lovingly, this sort of creative act that is living our lives is viral and has an effect on how other people live their lives. And so being avidly curious, being excited to go out into the world and to look at things, that's infectious for me, I feel. And that's part of the reason why I do this, is to try to kind of share some of my curiosities and to be able to let you see some of the things that I consider inspiring. I was listening to a podcast just the other day that was on comedy. I think it was Modern Day Philosophers. It's a great show. And what he does is he brings on different comedians usually, or actors. He had a pimp on at one point. It was also like a male pimp service. But he talks to these people, he asks them about their lives, and then eventually towards the end they go through philosophical quotes and they try to get deep. And he was talking to this one lady, her name was like Liz Miele or something, and they were talking about magic and the things that are shared, the qualities that are shared between magicians and comedians. And one of the things they talked about was wanting to share or to create surprise in other people, that all they really want to do is they're in the business of surprising because it's not something that you expect. And In my perusal of the world and its traditions, because I spend so much time reading primary source philosophical and religious texts, I start to see these trends and these similarities between thinkers. And for me, that's a big part of it, is when I'm reading through something that I might vibe with, or I might be sternly, starkly against it. New information, new ways of looking at the world, new aspects of how I can be, all these things that I would consider teachable moments. And when I find that moment, it's shocking and it's surprising, and it's like the light bulb going off in the cartoon where the idea is born immediately, that connection, that snap. I used to call it the aha moment, and it was shocking. It was surprising for me. And so I would take all these information bits, especially when I was younger, and I would go share them with people until somebody hadn't heard my particular information bit. And usually there's this light bulb yet again that goes off, and I can see it in somebody's eyes. And that's part of the thrill of wanting to share anything. That's why people tended to say that I should think about being an educator. But I didn't want to teach in schools, and I don't think I'm teaching here. I'm just sharing my experience and hoping that you can relate to it. And that's kind of the purpose of what I'm trying to do here. Reinstate it again. So thank you for letting me remind myself of what I'm doing and why I'm here. And today, I want to discuss division again. I want to discuss duality. Last week we were talking about all of the major dualisms from Ken Wilber in his book, The Spectrum of Consciousness. And the first one, just as a little refresher course, the first dualism, the first split, because if we consider everything as a unity, as one thing without a boundary, without an edge, it's not a bubble, it's totality, and it's inconceivable. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around. But what cuts that thing in half first is the distinguishment of self and other. And otherness being outside and selfness being inside, we've created a boundary. And then the second dualism would be of being versus not being, also thought of as life versus death. And with the self and the other, the self has now distinguished itself as more important than the other, than the environment, and it has the ability to not be. And in not being, and the ability to die, that is another crucial division. So now we have an independent self. The third division comes with psyche versus soma. Soma being the body, the physical, the vessel. This thing that I've spurned, even in past episodes, I've spurned the information that was able to be given to me by my own body. And then the psyche comes into the fourth quaternary split, the last dualism mentioned in this book, where the psyche is split into the persona and the shadow. And I really like this little digression, whether you want to think of rising up into ego or rising down into universal mind and totality. But these idea of dualisms can be seen in almost every single religious tract of thought, and particularly strongly in Eastern thought, where Buddhism has his dukkha, where suffering comes from desire. Desire itself is born from this inherent dualism where an inside wants something that's outside of itself, and that's the initial suffering. And of course, there's the noble truths and the ways of life, right living and right speech and right livelihood and all that kind of shit that tends towards bringing somebody away from desiring, which is hopefully going to split this existential dualism between the universe and ourselves. And a lot of that sounds hooty-dooty bullshit, and just as words, it's not very useful until we start to experience what it is like to have less needful desire, to have less need for control. And like, I know I always pressure people to live creatively, and that's a controlling act, but letting other people live creatively, even if it doesn't make sense, that's also a powerful act. was listening to Dan Cummins on my favorite podcast, Time Suck, and in his recent episode on McCarthyism, towards the beginning, he discusses how freedom in any free place, whether it's America or some other place that denotes itself as having freedom, but freedom's not freedom to choose. Freedom is freedom to disagree. It's not to just agree with everybody. Freedom is to be able to have a counter opinion, a counter movement that may even be damaging, you know? Like, but the freedom to make bad choices is the compelling part of free will. And so, when it comes to letting other people be and continuing our own track towards figuring out what the fuck we're doing, there's this fine line that comes there. And I see all these sort of parallels in these religious books again. So what happens with things like politics that may or may not be happening near you is we have this division socially, and society has an amalgamation and a glue that holds it together in aspects. And it's almost like I've said before that if you have people together in a space, they all start to think with this group mind. And the more people you get together, the more insane and infantile that group mind gets. So if you have millions of people, and then this fundamental dualism of ideology comes, where a line is drawn in the sand between peoples, then you have this separation. You have the shutdown of the outlet of love to and fro. And inevitably, there is a unreality to the whole situation. This is something I've been arguing online over the last couple days, is that this idea of a split between two groups of people, on one side being us and the other side being them, I believe that's a false distinguishment. It's as false as every other distinguishment that has started from mind. And we have to work within our systems, but to know it's false doesn't mean we can't play with it. And we played with these divisions of mass groups of people, you know. In the recent election that happened, and I'm not going to argue pros or cons to either side of the situation, I'm just going to look at this incredibly generally. But one of the things that I noticed with looking at data across the country of the United States, if you're not listening from here, is that there was such a close cut in almost every single state across the country. It was very close to 50-50. And I know that the popular and the electoral was, I don't really care. I don't give a shit who's sitting in the puppet chair. What I care the most vehemently about is how people are acting. And the last time there was such a divisive election like this in my country, it was very loud. And I remember I was working at a bigger establishment. I was working for a college in their cafeteria. And so this was one of the biggest kitchens I've ever worked in. 20 to 30 cooks working at a time, 550 people served in an hour. And so, of course, the environment was louder, so I had more opportunity to listen. But it seemed like everybody was talking about it, and there was a lot of aggression and a lot of emotions involved in why people were making the decisions they were making. This year, I work in a much smaller kitchen, but even outside of the real world on the technological verse, inside social media, which I also felt like was incredibly loud last time, it all seemed very quiet. I don't feel like I heard many people talking about it. I mean, I saw it mentioned on TV shows. One of my favorite TV shows, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, though it leans towards one side heavily, it's one of the only places that I heard anybody talking about it. And even now that after the election is gone, I'm only seeing one person routinely gloating, and it seems very quiet. Like there's not a lot of conversation, which makes me think that A, I'm experiencing a phenomena, and people have polarized to such an extent that they're not even conversing with each other, that there's not a back and forth, there's not an argument, because the camps have enclosed so much, they're like two little universes astride each other. And so, or I have isolated so far, and that my things I talk about and the things I look into and the things I discuss have gotten so minute that I've been put into a little tiny part of the world because I'm not interacting with all these schemes because I didn't care about politics, you know? And so now I'm not being fed all that shit, which that all goes to algorithms and stuff. And it starts to feel like a conspiracy theory at that point, so I don't think about it too much. But I guess I'm grateful I haven't had to have an onslaught of political nonsense. But I still know, technically, empirically, because of the data, that there is a massive split between people in my country. And a lot of people are scared, and a lot of people are being sore winners, and a lot of people are gloating. And it bothers me, and it makes me much more afraid than any sort of decision the executive branch could make. You know, because ultimately, I know that my life is not going to be impacted because of how I live. I do not have a strong set of social codes in my head. All too often throughout my life, I have made decisions on purpose to break the law and to go against what I'm supposed to do. And so it doesn't really matter what they tell me to do. My life, the way that I feel about who I am, is not going to change much. But of course, I'm also a white man in the United States, and there are huge tracts of people who are a lot more vulnerable than me. And so I feel a lot of tension, and I feel a lot of not love. I feel a lot of resistance. And I guess I chose to speak about this too much today is because that's the main idea here that I would like to impress upon anybody listening to my voice right now, is to realize that duality itself, from an epistemic spiritual standpoint, is, or at least could be, completely illusionary. Any split between two things, between black and white, between up or down, that you ever see has the chance to be one unity of idea, if we can conceptually think about it. So that means your brother and your sister and every single person on this, in this country, in this planet, every human being, every speck of life, we all share this kindred spirit of responsibility, I guess. We owe a certain responsibility to each other, to at least try to be compassionate, to try to do the best, and to allow others to be. And I don't know what the steps are to take to do that, but maybe you have some ideas, and I'd love to work with you to figure out how we can help each other. My email address, thegingerbreadmansdialogues, is available on the show notes, and you can reach out to me if you're feeling stressed or afraid, or if you just want to talk about and brainstorm some plans for self-respect and other respect and bringing the self and the other together. I would love to have a discourse and to speak about anybody, about anything. So please reach out to me if you want. But I want to get off the heaviness for a second, because I don't feel like I usually do that too much. And I want to discuss one of the new books that I'm reading before we sign off. I just picked up this book by P.D. Uspensky, which a couple years ago I do remember discussing him because I've already read one of his books. The first one was The Psychology of Man's Evolution. And I don't remember exactly the cliff notes from that one, but it left an impression on me enough so that I wanted another book by him that I bought like immediately afterwards. The first place that I ever heard him referenced was in Ram Dass, because in most of Ram Dass's books, after his chapters, he sometimes has a couple pages that'll just be quotes, like 10 to 15 quotes from different people that he all felt related to the chapter that he was talking about. And one of these names that I remember routinely being brought up was Uspensky. And he was a Russian philosopher. And I don't really know, I don't have a great understanding of the man. I need to learn his history. I think I need to go into his bio and learn about his life. I need to give more lives a chance, I'd love to read up about Nietzsche's life more and some of the other ones who left an impression on me. When you read the ancients, like in the classics, like the Greeks, you tend to get a mixture of their life because a lot of the times the philosophy was written in a play format. Uspensky does not write in a play format. He is cold and clerical, and he's trying to be concise. It's not flowery in any way, shape, or form. And it definitely had an impression on me. So the one I'm reading right now is called The Tertium Organum. And I like this title and the background to this title because it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of flaunting. It's being arrogant. The first organon would be by Aristotle, and it's basically Greek for organization. And it's where he goes in his categories and all of his ways that things relate to each other by predication. And these predicates may not be things in themselves, or they may be, but how you can logically ascertain these connections. And that's where logos and logic comes from, and that gets written to death. The second book on organization would be Newton's Novum Organum, which is one that I would definitely want on my shelves and to read at some point. And this is the book of scientific method, of scientific logic. Now, Tertium Organum is basically the third book of organization. And in his preface, he states that what he's really trying to dig into is what consciousness is. But the way he goes about doing that is by looking at it through a Kantian lens. I would consider Uspensky very neo-Kantian, if that makes any sense. So Kant thought that everything in life, there's a reality as it is, kind of like Plato's world of forms that he called the noumena. And then when we perceive things, we have these concepts that everything gets screened through, kind of like rose-colored glasses, like this filtering thing. So no matter what you look at, everything is going to be dyed red because of the glasses. And in this situation, the concepts, the glass color itself, is time and space. He calls these the only a priori concepts. A priori meaning before perception, and a posteriori being after. No, posteriori. Blah, 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 blah. I'm sorry. I'm losing myself. It's been a while since I read logic. So you can either have knowledge before perception, or you can have knowledge after perception. And after perception, you're building knowledge from experience and from memory. And this is called empiricism. And so a rationalist thinks that there's things you can know before anything. And then that would be kind of like a baby having instincts that nobody's taught it, to babble. Whereas the opposite of that would be a tabula rasa, which would be a blank slate, where you have an empty vessel that is instituted with customs. And honestly, it's probably a blend of the two, in my opinion. But using space and time, in the beginning of his book, he declares that they are fiction, that they're illusionary. You can't find space and time outside of the mind because they're concepts painted onto the noumena. And to go even deeper into this and to make it even more abstract, he brings in the fourth dimension. Sorry, I had to cut that there because my neighbors decided to vacuum their apartment for 30 minutes at 8 o'clock in the morning, which was fantastic. So where was I? I was starting to discuss the fourth dimension, where the fourth dimension in this situation would relate to Kant's idea of time. And Einstein brings in all the theories of relativity, where space and time seem to be a unit. Because, of course, even in the math, things are starting to condense and precipitate into this clear stuff. So I'm really glad that I had a precursor to a lot of these ideas, because I read this book called Flatland last year that had an immense impact on me and discusses the life of 2D shapes and 2D going into 3D and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things he says, I'm going to go grab it. One second. At the beginning of his chapter 6, he says, "A series of analogies and comparisons are used for the definition of that which can be and that which cannot be, in the region of the higher dimension. We imagine worlds of one and of two dimensions, and out of the relations of lower dimensional worlds to higher ones, we deduce possible relations of our world to one of four dimensions, just as out of the relations of points to lines, of lines to surfaces, and of surfaces to solids, we deduce the relations of our solids to four-dimensional ones. Let us try to investigate everything that this method of analogy can yield. So, what he's referencing there is if you think of a one-dimensional world, well, that would just be kind of like the totality in my head, the unity, the universal mind discussed by a lot of these theologians and spiritualists. But mathematically, and to think from outside of this one-dimensional world, it would be just a point, right? Just a dot and a speck, surrounded, not surrounded, I don't know. So if you were to look at a line and the relationship of a point to a line, you could consider a line to be an infinite arrangement of points, all in a row outside of the dimension of one dimension, in that second dimension of length, that creates this pointed line. And to take it a step further, imagine that line and then a whole bunch of lines next to each other, you'd start to have a square, you know, like depending on how you set up the lines. And so all of a sudden, surfaces in the flat plane sense are arrangements of lines, just as lines are arrangements of points. And so now think of our third dimension that has surfaces put into width and depth. And now there's this substance that we're used to in our perception of world, theoretically. All this shit hurts my brain even when I try to talk about it. So to consider the fourth dimension, imagine every place you've ever been and every possibility where you could be. And your fourth dimensional shape would be the untemporal situationship of everywhere you will and ever will be. And you're like, it kind of makes me think of like, I don't know. I always kind of see like a snake in my head, like a snake snaking through time. Like behind me would be the shadow image of myself. But yet again, that's a poor reference because it's inside my way of perceiving the world. It's how I perceive things with these three dimensions. And so the fourth angle, the fourth layer, the way that I perceive time might not even be as how reality actually is. And then my brain just crumbles into a slurp and it just falls away. So I've just started this book, but over the next couple weeks, I'll be discussing it more. And I don't know. What do we do with this kind of knowledge? Like, what's the point of eradicating space and time? Because it's kind of how I feel like what Kant was kind of trying to do in a way. He's trying to utilize space and time to make it put like a little bit more reasonableness on our perceptions, you know, instead of putting too much stake in the map, instead of knowing what the actual place looks like, because the map is never going to be exactly like the place. But really, it's unnecessary. I was having a discussion with my therapist about this, but I don't really know any real reason for reading about any of this stuff. It doesn't help me live in my life. It's almost kind of like a brain puzzle, because I feel like if I can wrap my head around some of these people's ideas, I feel like I've succeeded. Like, it's satisfying. But you don't really ever have to think about fourth dimensional beings to go live your life. It's completely unnecessary. And there's probably some really short Eastern books out there, like the Tao Te Ching or the Dhammapada, that you can read in 20 minutes and will have a lot of really useful, utilizable information on how to live one's life for the rest of their life. You know, there's some Western philosophy books like this that I have to read really slowly, and it might take me months to digest, and I'm not sure if it'll have a huge impact on my life other than making me feel like I've expanded mentally somehow, which is the complete opposite of what any Eastern mystic and any Taoist or Buddhist monk would advise you do. But in a way, I kind of think of game theory here, and consider life kind of like a game, and there's rules and all the social constructs of how and what we're supposed to do. Knowing that we're in a game gives power, gives freedom,
because then you can choose how and what you want to do with life and how you play the game. But to sign off here, I want to share one last little quote from Ken Wilber that I think will tie this up nicely. Here we go. The point of all this will be glaringly obvious if we now ask the simple question, what happens if we draw inappropriate distinctions? Straightforwardly, an inappropriate distinction can lead to self-contradictory or paradoxical rules, which in turn can lead to self-defeating and self-frustrating games. And a society built on such a self-defeating game is an ideal breeding ground for neurosis and psychosis. That is, the distinctions, rules, and contradictions and paradoxes, so that trying to act upon them places the double bind on us all, for this type of game has rules that ensure that we will never win the game. So that means being outside the game, being able to critically think about stuff, you get to creatively choose which rules you put a lot of stock in. Kind of like I was mentioning earlier, you know, I kind of feel outside of the social construction and I get to choose what I do. But there's power in that. I don't know if I got to the point I wanted to here, but I hope that I said something relatable and I hope I gave you something to think about. And I hope you feel a little bit less alone than when you logged on to the show. So thank you so much for being here. Go get O. We'll sign you out.
Hello, it's Gingerbread and Asko. I'm sorry. I
thought it was Asko Elemental. QRS-TV.
I'm sorry, I couldn't mess up at that part.
You did great.
Okay. Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen.
What's happening?
Well, if it's winter and it's really icy right now.
Is that a lot of snow?
Yes.
You had 3 snow days in a row.
Yes.
That's crazy. Well, lucky boy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen.
Do you have any advice?
Any advice?
How to stay warm?
Sure. Advice to stay warm?
Crickets. Chirp, chirp. It's because he always goes out in his sweatpants. All right, guys.
Give me a second. Give me a second real quick.
We appreciate you. We'll talk to you later.
So I was checking out the cats.
Bye.
Bye.